Hello, and welcome to the Central Work Script Club. I'm Patricia Milton, and in this episode, I'm speaking with Lauren Smirkanich about her world premiere play, The Dignity Circle. We're joined at about the 22-minute mark by Central Work's resident sound designer, Gregory Sharpen, who also engineers this podcast. Lauren is a writer-director currently based in Los Angeles, where she has worked most recently with the Echo Theater Company and Theater of Note. Read more about Lauren in our show notes. Well, Lauren, thanks for doing this interview.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm really interested to know about your theatrical origin story and how you first got interested in writing for the theater.
I was really lucky. I grew up in a household of avid readers. I inherited that trait, and I think that's why I started making sense of the world through stories and processing my own thoughts through journals and writing. And so that was probably the very, very beginning of it. And then, you know, this is not that unique. I did a high school play and it was awesome. And it was a whole bunch of, I mean, I'm sure the quality of the production was not itself awesome. It was an incredible experience with a bunch of weird, wonderful people. And I was lucky enough to go to college for it as well. Yeah, I don't think I ever, I went to college for acting and I don't actually think I wanted to be an actor. I think I wanted to be in that high school production over and over again. You know, I think I wanted to do theater camp actually forever. So I think I'm still just chasing that. I'm trying to always find my way back to theater camp. I do have a production. I remember thinking, being in the audience as a relatively young kid and thinking I want in on that magic. And I was really lucky when I was little. My dad traveled a lot for work and he would take us with him. And I was in London and I got to see the Scottish play at the Old Globe.
Wow.
Yeah, I was like 10 maybe, and I had no idea what was going on. I think looking back, they must have set it in the 30s and kind of a, you know, they were dealing with authoritarianism and fascism, and the only set piece was this giant marble looking slab that they hung from the rafters, and they used it for the banquets and they used it as a bed. And when Lady Macbeth did her out speech, she started on one side of the slab and she walked back and forth, and it turned into this giant pendulum with this small woman on it shouting about getting blood off of her hands. And I didn't know what was going on, but I felt what was going on. And I remember thinking, well, this is it. I mean, there's nothing better than this. So that is a production I remember very clearly from being a kid and thinking I want to be a part of that.
Fantastic. Now, mine was a King Lear.
Oh, so we both have Shakespeare.
Yeah, also yeah. Shakespeare. And it was set in some kind of primitive, I don't know, everybody was wearing bearskins,
yes,
and had knives in their armbands. I remember thinking, this is the greatest play about the wronged daughter. You know, that was my point of view about King
Lear,
was that it was about a daughter who's not treated right.
I love that. And I agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So let's come around to the Dignity Circle. And I'm really interested in your inspiration for that.
I had never heard of a gifting circle prior to 2020, which I think is when I started doing preliminary writing on this. It was just popping up in my newsfeed every once in a while. There was a Washington Post article about how these proliferated during the pandemic, as they often do during times of crisis. And it had been featured in an HBO documentary as well. That's not what the documentary was about, but they were in there. And I just started poking and doing some reading about them and some reading on circles that had gotten giant and had been broken up in the United States. I felt, you know, that little tingle where you're like, that's a play. It's,
yeah.
It's just really interesting, the women who fall for these, and it is often, though not always, women. These pyramid schemes tend to target women and marginalized communities. The women who fall for them and the women who perpetrate them, and why they fall for them, and what motivates them to start something like this.
Yeah, it's interesting because it really seems to not have anything to do with intelligence. The people are perfectly smart, but there's just something, some type of longing that this meets.
I think so. I think it's very easy to say that somebody who would fall for something like this is stupid or unaware, and I don't think that's true at all. I think if that were the case, this would stop, and it hasn't stopped. It's been going on for, interestingly enough, as a sidebar, I had been talking to this about this with a friend, and they said they had come across some letters from their great aunt from like the 1910s, and she was describing a gifting circle that she had fallen for. So these have been going on forever. So if it had to do with stupidity or gullibility, I think that would have stopped. I think you're right. I think it speaks to some deeper longing that we have to connect.
Mm-hmm. So given this, are there different themes or elements that you come back to again and again in your work?
I've been thinking about this a little bit, and I think that the simplest way to put it is I think that Dignity Circles really shows this, is I'm really interested in the female relationship with capitalism. Obviously, when the powers that be decided that this was how we were going to organize the majority of our societies and the world, those powers were men, and they couldn't even conceive of a world where women would actively participate in commerce and capitalism. And I'm really interested in how do women function in a society that didn't even consider that they would participate, and how do they thrive in a society like that? That's what I find very interesting about gifting circles, is they are a microeconomy that services a very specific need. They're definitely predatory, but one could argue so is capitalism. So I find myself...
One could.
In different ways, I find myself kind of mulling over how women engage with making money legally, illegally. I'm just interested in that, the tension between money and how women get it.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. So let me ask you, you are also a director.
Yes.
And does that inform and influence your writing? I imagine it does. So can you talk about that?
It does. I do think since it's two different steps in the process, it sometimes feels like there's a very clear line demarcated in my brain between one set of problem-solving skills and another set of problem-solving skills. I find that when I'm writing, I'm thinking about structure, I'm thinking about character, how best to efficiently tell a story, and directing to me feels so much more about taking that and making it full and alive and also efficient, I suppose, and suiting it to the space and the people who are also working on a given project with me. So there is a clear demarcation in my mind between the two skill sets. I do think, interestingly enough, that the thing that connects them was my training as an actor. Because I think I learned when I was acting that the two most important things in any theatrical endeavor are to always take your character's side and to tell the truth. And I really strive to do both of those things when I'm both writing and directing. So it's all in the same brain, but it does sometimes feel like it's different compartments in the suitcase, you know what I mean?
And
interestingly enough, even though I haven't acted for years and years and years, I think the skill set that I honed when I was thinking about being an actor is the thing that keeps the suitcase together to go with it. I don't know. You don't usually need to keep a suitcase together, but it's the zipper on the suitcase. There we go.
Exactly. Keeps the baggage inside.
Exactly.
So you may have already told me this earlier, but what, do you have a story about your childhood that tells us something about you as a writer?
This is not a flattering story about myself. I want to preface this with, I mean, I just was talking about telling the truth. I really I think it's very important to tell the truth in life and in art. I was 7 when this happened, and I'm just going to preface it by saying I'm so sorry to my younger brother. So I was a very typical oldest sibling in that I pretty much always wanted to be left alone. And he was a very typical youngest sibling in that he just followed me around and wanted to be involved in what I was doing. Not because I was doing anything cool, but because I was older and around. He was driving me nuts one day, and I looked him in the eye and I raised my arm and I bit myself really, really hard, like hard enough to leave marks, which eventually turned into bruises. And I ran to my dad and I said, "Nick bit me." And in my head, my dad grew like 90 feet tall and bellowed that we didn't bite people in this household. And Nick got in trouble, but he left me alone. And we did not, I mean, Nick had nothing to come clean about. I did not really come clean about that until I was well into adulthood. Like, my father was shocked that I had lied. And I don't think that made me a good writer, necessarily, but it did prep me for writing somebody like Angela.
Sure.
Somebody who manipulates things and presents the truth in a way to get them what they want.
It's also extremely dramatic.
There was bellowing, there was high tension. It was operatic in scope, especially for my poor younger brother. But
it's so funny when it's a little kid, it's like lying is a superpower. You know, it's, boy, I can just say I didn't do it or say somebody else did it. But then you eventually begin to realize the ramifications of doing that.
Oh, yeah. I like to think, I mean, you'll have to ask my father, but I like to think I was a pretty good kid, but that was lying was a big thing for me. They really had to break that habit because you're exactly right. It's a superpower. I didn't have to get in the pool, but if I got my swimsuit wet and brought it home from camp, they thought I went in the pool, and who am I to change that narrative for them? Yeah, yeah. Definitely helpful in writing Angela.
So speaking of Angela, she is such a complicated character. And I wondered if you drew her at all from anybody that you know. I mean, obviously, you don't need to go into detail, but is she somebody you know?
Well, clearly bits and pieces are me, but I suppose you could say that about any character you write. No, I am grateful that I do not know an Angela. The way I formulated her was I knew for the play that I wanted to write that I needed a shark. You know, I needed a predator. Somebody who really is comfortable. I mean, I don't think it's too harsh a word to say that she abuses the trust of others and is comfortable with that. But I didn't want her to be a villain. So I knew what she had to do. And I kept thinking about, why would she do this and how would she justify it to herself? What are her particular mental gymnastics? So I took her side at every opportunity, really. And I think that's what ended up making this woman. Her actions and her justifications for her actions almost don't seem to align, but in this woman, they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very, very fascinating character. Can you talk a little bit about the Central Works Writers Group, which I was in several of them with you while you were working on this play, and how it helped or influenced the development of it?
As you well know, the greatest asset to something like that is just sheer accountability. When I'm writing, I hate producing pages. I'm one of those writers who loves a rewrite but hates the blank, you know, the cursor blinking at me. Mm-hmm. So when you have to have a certain number of pages on a certain day, that's huge. And I think Gary Graves, who directed the play and who facilitates that workshop, has really put together, every time that I've participated in the workshop, a group of people who have such a high level of intelligence, such a high level of respect for one another, honesty, craftsmanship, just good old dramaturgical know-how that it's just a giant gift to any writer who gets to be involved in it. I think this play, I very much knew where I wanted to go with it. It felt like a lot of the pieces clicked together in my head before I put them on the page. But the writers group helped me so much with clarifying character. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to have this idea of who somebody is, who Judith or Angela are, but they're kind of this amorphous, ethereal sprite thing in your head, and then somebody in workshop goes, oh, I think Judith did this because of that. And you go, yeah, I think they did. I think you're right. Being able to speak to other writers, and especially writers of such intelligence and generosity, helps you define who you're writing so much. And I'm grateful for the chance that I get to, any moment that I get to be in there. I really look forward to it every week when we do it.
Me too. I feel like kindness. Everybody's kind, you know, which when it, like you said, you feel so vulnerable bringing your work in. And so that's a huge bonus, is that people are kind. And then also, for me, I usually do, well, I don't always, but often, I know where my play is going, but I don't know how to make that clear to other people.
Right.
So having these other people say, well, I don't understand that.
Yeah.
Is so helpful.
So helpful. And every time, so I think I've been in the workshop 3 times now. To your point about kindness, there's so little ego in the room too, mm-hmm. I feel. It's really about the pages that everybody brings in and helping one another make those pages clearer and better and more exciting. Yeah, it's a real gift.
So on these podcasts, I talk to playwrights and I have usually asked them about the pandemic and the lockdown mm-hmm. and how it influenced their writing. So can you talk about your lockdown experience?
Oh, it was so fun. I was really thriving. I was working out so much and drinking a lot of... It was obviously awful. Writers crave quiet and not being interrupted and time to focus. I mean, your greatest commodity as a writer is time. And we got a lot of it. So it was... Most writers I've spoken to, and I definitely would agree with this, were in a way very grateful for the time. And we can, I think, say that now because we've opened up again and we can gather again, and it doesn't feel quite so scary. I think for me too, I was headed this direction anyway, but the pandemic definitely accelerated it, where I made the decision with the support of my amazing family to commit myself to only doing creative work, which obviously is... I'm very lucky to be able to do so, and it's financially very scary, but I don't know, when the sky is on fire and you don't know if you can leave your house, I couldn't justify a life making Excel spreadsheets look like other Excel spreadsheets and going to corporate Zoom meetings when I could be doing what I wanted to do. It felt like time was more important and precious, and I really had the feeling of, if not now, when? So I made a switch in that time, and I'm very happy that I did. And to be coming out of that with the support of a theater like Central Works, I can't articulate how grateful I am and how excited I am to say that after, you know, a really tough 3 years, I have something that I'm really proud of and that I've worked on with people who are incredible.
Mm-hmm. They have this term called the Great Resignation.
I was part of that. People,
yes. Yeah. Good for you. But
thanks.
I think it's so funny when people go, gee, why doesn't anybody want to work in corporate America anymore?
Yeah.
I wonder. It seems kind of self-evident. But.
Well, exactly. I think that I've been working in a professional or semi-professional theatrical capacity my entire adult life and my entire career. I'm really proud of that and very lucky to have done that. But I had a corporate job for most of that too. So I do think that I might have a certain insight into how those two worlds are similar and how they're incredibly dissimilar and how they collide. So yes, I do think that that's why I write about capitalism so much, is because of my day job experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of Central Works, is there anything in particular you'd like to mention about your work with Central Works on this piece?
It's been a pleasure. I met Gary Graves. I took one of his playwriting classes at Berkeley Rep, and he was immediately very supportive and kind, and offered great feedback on, this was like 3 or 4 plays ago, the first thing he read of mine. And I think he was one of those people who said something encouraging to me at the right time. And so I kept going, and I'm very happy I kept going. And I think he has never had anything but the absolute best interests for this story at heart, which is just really gratifying. It's a lovely, safe feeling. The cast is incredible. If you come out and see it, please come out and see it. You're just going to be blown away by the level of talent from both the cast and the crew and the team that brought you the spectacle you're going to see. And I think also Central Works is very legitimate. And by that, I mean, we've all worked with smaller theater companies, and in a smaller theater company, it's such a labor of love to put on a show. It's impossible, and somehow it gets done again and again and again. But that doesn't always mean you're paid for your time or thanked for your time or your time is considered. And my experience with this company thus far has been that every effort is to make you know that for the amount of time that you are working together on this production, you're a valuable member, you will be compensated. You're not going to be able to buy a chateau in France, but it's something to feel appreciated for the work that you do and being compensated for the work that you do. And I've paired with the respect I have for writers and actors is really pretty tremendous. Mm-hmm. Also, not for nothing, the space is so cool. I mean, I never thought I'd be having a play go up in a castle, and it legitimately looks like a castle, and the theater is so unique and challenging and bizarrely perfect for so many different settings. And I feel very lucky that Gary has been working in it for so long that he knows all the tricks to make it look as good as possible. It's been a blast. It's just been an absolute joy.
It's such an interesting space with all of its eccentricities.
Yes.
The audience is inside the stage. Yeah, I love it.
Which works really well for our piece because so much of it is basically a sales pitch directly to the audience to join our con. And it's just so perfect to be that close to the audience in our play.
Yeah, love it.
Yeah.
I wonder, there is one thing that I'd like to talk about the play. I think I might have talked to you, Lauren, about this before, but one of the things that I find particularly interesting about this play is that there are a number of instances when characters whose motivations you might have suspicions of, or characters you might not particularly like, say things that are absolutely spot on and correct. And that so incredibly complicates your relationship to those characters, having someone who you might have doubts about going, no, I think they're right on that. And that twist is something I don't think enough people do in their plays to complicate an audience's relationship with the characters. And I'm wondering if you could maybe talk about that and whether that was a conscious decision or whether that just sort of emerged out of the writing.
I think my answer to that would be twofold. One, I think that speaks to that idea of telling the truth from both a creative standpoint, from trying to tell this particular story. The best liars are the ones who tell mostly the truth. And I think that I did want to illustrate that in this piece. And then I think a little bit, I see the value in these gifting circles, and I do not see the value in preying on other women. I do not see the value in lying. But part of what a lot of these circles do is they will gather weekly or semi, you know, they'll gather on a certain schedule, and they will have these sessions where women kind of brainstorm ideas as to how to help one another. And whether it be with how do I navigate a divorce, how do I get out of a bad job, I'm dealing with breast cancer, who else has been here? And I think that is incredible. And I think that is valuable. So I think the nature of these gifting circles themselves are what you're speaking to, very predatory, not trustworthy, do not have your best interests at heart. But at the same time, they do provide support that we don't often get in every casual, everyday casual life. They do offer a community, and people are so desperate for community. I tried to emulate the nature of gifting circles in the writing.
Yeah, I feel like one of the things that came across to me is that they offer also ritual.
Yeah.
They offer ritual, and I really think we don't have enough of that in modern day America. Yeah. I think it's very important. It's something that is in every culture, everywhere in the world, except we don't have very much of it.
Right. We don't have the same pageantry that I think certain cultures do. We don't have the same traditions because we are a capitalistic society.
Yeah,
and because
exactly.
There is what would have maybe at one time been gathering in church for a holiday is gone. And I'm certainly not advocating for that. Everybody's beliefs are their own, but there's been nothing to replace that. That's something that a lot of the women who've fallen prey to these cons have said, you know, walking into a ballroom full of women screaming about an excitement over the ceremony of somebody making it to the top of the circle is like the biggest rush of adrenaline and support. They feel euphoric when they're done. And yeah, that definitely speaks to the lack of tradition and pageantry that I think most of us feel.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell me one or two of your favorite moments in the Dignity Circle without giving too much away?
Yes. Yes. No spoilers. So there are a lot of awkward run-ins in supermarkets in this play. And I don't think this gives too much away, but basically the local high-end grocery chain turns into a cruising ground for recruiting people to this particular con. I just had a blast writing those. I mean, writing an awkward scene is so much fun, but it's a very casual, low-stakes environment to write a scene where one person wants something so badly from the other, and the other doesn't know what the stakes are. So that was just, they were so much fun to write. And I think, you know, speaking to your question about COVID lockdown, because so much of this was written in like late 2020, early 2021, and my one weekly excursion was to the supermarket, that's probably why. I didn't really think about that until this interview, that it was probably because that's the only place I was going to at the time. Mm-hmm. And I felt so alive when I was in Trader Joe's, you know? So I think those have ended up being my favorite parts of the play.
Great. And what would you like audiences to take away?
I hope that people have a sense of, can empathize with why Judith and Angela make the decisions that they make. I think I spoke to this a little bit earlier, but this idea that it's very easy to judge why someone would hurt someone else, why someone would fall for something that seems so obviously a con, why someone would maybe return to a relationship that isn't the best for them, why someone would hurt someone else. And I think it's very easy to make judgment calls about those actions when it's never that clear cut or simple. What motivates people to do any of those things is so much more complicated and so much more interesting than a snap judgment. So I would hope that people would engage with these characters without immediate judgment. We're always vulnerable in a supermarket. And that's a great unifier. That's a very, you know, democratizing state. We are all vulnerable in supermarkets.
And I love that vulnerability in a supermarket. That's why they have those aisles with no candy in them.
Exactly.
I want to thank you so much. We are recording this on opening week. And as I understand it, opening night is fully reserved. So I'm going to be there. I'm really excited to see it.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us for the Central Work Script Club. For more information about the Dignity Circle and to order tickets, visit centralworks.org.